It's June 17th, 2010. I'm Joe Corey, the interviewer, and I'm going to be interviewing Mae Freitas, who was an important component part of the Office of Placement and Advising. And Mae, welcome to the interview.
Thank you, Joe.
And I wondered if you'd begin by just telling us some of the background you feel is significant in terms of bringing you to the UW.
Okay, well, I grew up in New York. I was the daughter of, I am the daughter of Holocaust survivors. I was the first person in my family to come to college, and I came to the University of Wisconsin in the fall of 1960 when I was 17 years old. I loved it here as a student, as an undergraduate. It was a turbulent time. It was a little bit before the war in Vietnam, but there was still a lot of political activism, and there was activism, and there were civil rights. There were a lot of things going on in that era. I was here until 1965. I was an English major. I have a Bachelor of Arts degree in English from the University of Wisconsin. I then went back to New York, and I received my master's degree from Hofstra University in education. I taught for 3 years on Long Island. I taught seventh grade English, which I consider my punishment for every terrible thing I've ever done in life. And in the summer of, I think, maybe 67, I decided to come through Madison on my vacation on my way to what was going to be San Francisco, where I thought I was going to be studying creative writing. And instead, what happened when I came back to Madison is that I really sort of came home in a way. There were still a lot of people that I cared about here. And I became involved in a pilot program that ended up being a really interesting job. I was hired to prepare families on public assistance for the GED, the high school equivalency exam, doing the English and social studies part. This was through University Extension, the Center for Community Leadership Development. Ken Lehman was the director. And so I became involved in what I would call adult education,
right,
which I was much better at. There was no discipline involved. Instead, you had to motivate people. And and one of the things that I learned there that I think is important for later is that I learned that as a teacher, as an advisor, as whatever you do, you need to set goals that you can reach. 110 sometimes, I did, I was idealistic, I thought I could change people's lives, and what a surprise, I couldn't, but I could make a real difference for 45 minutes a day, or an hour a day, in a finite way in terms of the quality of a person's experience.
Probably even more significant, perhaps, for adults who've gotten past the college years of experimentation and that sort of thing and need to really zero in on something?
Exactly. Uh-huh. And also because these were people whose lives were very chaotic.
Yeah.
So to have just a, to be able to learn, to focus, to discuss, to read a book was a hugely positive experience for a lot of people. I did that for 9 years. This was in the Johnson years when there was a lot of money on the war on poverty. And more and more, as when Nixon got elected, there was a more and more having to fundraise, look for ways to house this program elsewhere, and it became harder and harder to do that, and I liked that less and less. I was unemployed for 6 months, the only time in my life. It was enormously instructive. It gave me a real sense of what it meant to not have, not only to not have, you know, the have a salary, but to not have the identity of having work. And it gave me, I think, some insight and some sensitivity to doing career advising later, to have that, that experience, you know.
Maybe we should go back, though, a little bit, because I'm aware that you had some unique experiences as a result of your dad that kind of helped prepare you for coming to Wisconsin and all that it entailed as a university in that period.
Yeah, I mean, it was not a coincidence that I came to Wisconsin, which was a liberal university. My father, who I mentioned before, had been a Holocaust survivor, was drafted into the U.S. Army when he first came to the United States, to New York, and he was sent to Tyler, Texas, to a base in Tyler, Texas, where he discovered in the mess hall that German war prisoners and white American GIs were eating together.
And what years were this about?
This is probably 1940, maybe, 1941.
Oh,
perhaps.
Okay, we're way back at the start of WWII,
yeah.
Okay.
African American GIs were in a segregated dining hall. Mm-hmm. This was shocking to him. He immediately identified as a person who had experienced persecution in Europe with the segregation of black GIs, and it was a story, one of those stories that got told over and over again in the family.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in high school, and the civil rights movement was officially gaining energy in the South, as you, I'm sure, remember, Woolworths had picket lines,
right.
And there were picket lines in the North to support the attempt to integrate lunch counters in the South. My father took me to my first picket line in the early 60s, maybe. So this was an important in terms of forming my own attitudes, but also that whatever career I undertook, the notion of justice, the notion of racial equality, and the notion of feeling that we all have a responsibility, that we're not born into a new world,
mm-hmm.
we're born into a world where things have happened. And even though we may not have done certain things, we are responsible for at least making it better during our lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
So, fast forward to when I did, in fact, start to work on campus as a career advisor in the career advising office. That was one of the really, to me, a really strong pull, was to make sure that the services of that office were available to all students, and in some ways to focus on students who may not have traditionally had access.
But before we leave some of the background,
yes,
are there any comments about your student life that you want to say anything about what UW did or did not mean to you, or whether conceivably you've only thought more about it long afterwards too? After all, we're kind of young when we're going through undergraduate experience.
Yes, yeah, that's true. There was a lot happening without necessarily analyzing it at the time. I probably, one of the happiest times in my life were my undergraduate days here, for a variety of reasons. Living in the dorms. As an only child, I had never lived with other young people before.
Mm-hmm.
Finding peers to live with, that was a new experience for me. It was really a great experience.
How long did you live in the dorms?
I lived in Elm Drive A for 1 year. When I was a sophomore, there was housing that was called independent housing. There were houses that were, there were house mothers.
Yes, right.
And there were ours.
And the buildings had been inspected by university personnel.
Yes, yeah. So mm-hmm. I moved to Gilman Street.
Okay.
The big city part of Madison, from the dorms. Actually, I have to say, to back up for a moment, coming from New York, even though I lived in the suburbs, but coming from New York and then being for the first time away from home and having it be Elm Drive and the Lake Path was a huge change. And it was fabulous. It was wonderful. There wasn't a moment that I didn't feel how wonderful it was, how beautiful, and how meeting people from all over. There's a way in which when you come from a large city or near a large city, you do, of course, have in some ways a cosmopolitan experience.
Mm-hmm.
But there is another kind of way of opening up by coming to a place like the Midwest where you've never been before, and meeting people from, northern Minnesota was just as exciting and interesting as, you know, meeting people from a large city, that which I had done before. So I would say that those years were, and also as a liberal arts major, as an English major, I was originally an art major, and then because my father was an artist, I decided I wanted my own thing. I didn't want to pursue art after all. And so I majored in English, and that was amazing, you know. I had always enjoyed reading, but doing it in a more formal way and learning how to analyze literature and how to write and how to communicate. And I just remember those years as just full of stimulation and friendship and excitement, and of course the politics, because I had been raised in a home where politics mattered.
Mm-hmm.
I use the word politics loosely. Social change and talking about those things. And so, I mean, I remember George Wallace came to campus to the Wisconsin Union, and there were so many people who wanted to hear him. There were loudspeakers set up throughout the building, you know. That was an important protesting against his views. I remember John Kennedy being assassinated. I was in the Ratskeller playing bridge. Very important part of my undergraduate mm-hmm. experience, playing bridge in the Ratskeller. And suddenly, kind of this murmur coming up, and the notion that, the fact that John Kennedy had been shot, not that
right.
he had been killed.
Right.
And they brought a TV set, they wheeled a TV set out to the archway between the Union and, you know, the Paul Bunyan room and the mm-hmm. trophy room, and mm-hmm. under that arch. Of course, then it was unusual to have a TV. Now they're everywhere on
yeah.
the campus. And I remember we all kind of stood around, and you know, it was just awful when we found out that he'd been killed. And I remember calling home and wanting my father to tell me the world wasn't going to come to pieces. And as which reminds me too, there was the Cuban crisis.
That's right.
In yep. those years as well, and calling home. My poor father, he was in charge of the world, you know, from my point of view. Every time there was something that happened in the world, I called home, and he told me it was going to be all right. And he was right.
Good.
So anyway, also the fact that you could pursue, you know, whatever intellectually was interesting to you and not have to worry much about a job, interestingly enough, in those days. From 1960 to 1965, it is my impression that if you had a college degree, I mean, we didn't even worry about what we were going to do, to tell you the truth. I had never been to a career advising office. It never occurred to me that that would be necessary.
Right. No. I think that's an important point to make.
Yeah, you know, so
generations coming after us.
Now, I do think, interestingly enough, that for women, and this is a big change, unless you were really an unusual, academically oriented, you know, a Margaret Mead kind of person, that would be one thing. But for most of my women friends and I, we ended up either as teachers, nurses, or social workers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm sure there are exceptions to
right.
this. But there were so that was such a trend for women in college those days. I don't know if you agree with that, but it seemed to me that that was a pretty tip. Unless now, of course, I'm sure there were women who pursued academic careers and went on to graduate school, but that was not necessarily. I didn't know too many of those people. There was also the Peace Corps. People were going off to the Peace Corps.
That's right. Yeah,
pretty
that's a good
typically.
Point. Mm-hmm.
It was a time of hope. It was a time where you felt that you could really affect change in a larger world. This is a little bit before the Vietnam.
Definitely.
So it was really when I came back in 67 as a young teacher and really moved back to Madison as a young adult, but on campus, that I really experienced the anti-war movement. You know, mm-hmm. I lived on State Street. I remember there was tear gas every night in my apartment because those buildings were old, and that tear gas would just seep in.
Oh boy!
You know, there'd be this film, kind of an oily film on the drapes, you know, and I remember teaching on State Street in the not the extension building, but the maybe it was the extension building on
Langdon.
On
State Street
on
itself.
On State across from Allen Hall.
Yeah, they rented space in one of those.
Yes.
Because it was a private dormitory in the upper floors. I can't remember the name.
Yeah.
Specific
and
name
that's
of it.
Where that school existed.
Yeah.
And
okay.
So these women mm-hmm. would come, and they would be terrified of the women in the GED program.
Mm-hmm.
The WIN program, the work incentive training program, was the state piece of the funding. And then the University Extension had a piece of it as well with the pilot school.
Okay.
So, but I mean, it was all happening while in the streets the war at home was going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's an interesting time. In fact, later on, we had a recruiter later come to the office from he was either from the CIA or the NSA. He'd been an attaché in Vietnam, and he had come to interview, and we teased him, and we said he'd been in Vietnam, he'd missed all the action in Madison, Wisconsin during the war, the Vietnam War, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so that was a huge, I lived on State Street the summer that Sterling Hall was bombed. I heard the bomb, I felt the bomb. It was open, it was I think August perhaps.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The windows were open. And I remember being awakened and thinking that a plane had crashed in State
Street. I think we're talking 1970, aren't we? I think so.
Perhaps
August of
1970. 1970, yeah. And I remember getting up and looking out the window. There was no plane, so I went back to sleep. And then the next day, of course, we learned the building had been bombed. And I have had people who were not here, who either older and younger people, say, "Oh, it must have been all of this must have been so terrible during college years." But it wasn't. It was exciting and full of stimulation and feeling that the society that you were really a member of your opinion was mattered, and it I think it was for me it was ideal. It fit for me. I was lucky in that because I had been raised to think about things like that. So
your point about the bombing, and this is an aside for anybody listening to this at some point, is because as you and I are talking, May, some people in the university are getting prepared to celebrate, or to at least commemorate would be a better word, the 40th anniversary of the Sterling bombing.
Oh.
But there's tension still in the air of some who feel that to do that, there's just too much still out there. There's too much hurt, one way or the other, and to do it. So it'll be interesting to see the way that, whether it does come off. I'm not sure who the specific individuals are, but I've seen emails starting to circulate about this.
Well, I think it's interesting when you reach a certain age that things that were just a part of your life become history.
Mm-hmm.
It's a funny feeling. Anyway, that's an example,
of
that. Yeah.
Well, maybe that's a good point for us to segue into your career here at Madison. Would you describe for us how you got your job and who you worked for and things of that nature for a starter?
Well, I think that another reason that I was, to the extent that I was helpful as a career advisor, it had to do with the fact that I'd never thought that one had to literally look like, in terms of one's degree and one's experiences, what one was going to apply for. I mean, unless you're talking about a technical field, you know, obviously, if you're going to do brain surgery, you maybe should know some. But that in the world, there are many other factors to why we end up doing what we do. And I was an example of it because I was unemployed for 6 months. I was applying for everything under the sun. I thought I was a school teacher. My resume was a school teacher resume. And a friend of mine happened to mention academic staff listings. I also sent out a million resumes to I didn't know what career advising was, but that was one of them, one of the jobs. And I miraculously landed an interview with the then director, Ed Weidenfeller. This was in 1977, probably. Maybe the winter of 1977, I think. I think so.
Okay.
And so I was called, I think that Ed was the kind of person who didn't think, who did think outside of the box, as we now say, and who realized, read between the lines of my resume, that even though I was calling myself a school teacher, the kind of teaching and the population I had been teaching implied that I had some sense of the relationship between career and teaching,
mm-hmm.
that mattered to these women, for example. So anyway, he called me in, and we had a great interview. I was, and this is another thing that I learned that I later used in advising. I was so sure that I couldn't possibly get this job because I wasn't something called a career advisor, that I was very relaxed in the interview. I thought this is just an experience that I'm having, and it made me better a better interviewee. And I think it really contributed to the fact that we had really a good chemistry in
there. You and Ed Weidenfeller in this,
yes,
yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Anyway, I got the job, and I frankly learned the job by doing the job. I remember, for example, there was a book, as you probably know, a book called The Occupational Handbook, which is put out by the Department of Labor every year. It's a tome. It's a heavy, well, it used to be. Now it's probably online.
That's true, yeah.
But it used to be one of these big, heavy books that had every career in the world and what the qualifications were and the salaries and the job outlook. I mean, there were thousands of occupational titles in this book. And every night I would carry home this book. And I'd, you know, start with the A, the career starting with A, because I wanted to learn the job. And Ed said to me one day, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm trying to catch up." He said, "You don't have to read that book. You have to know that that book exists, and you can refer students to it as a resource." That was, I'd never thought of that. I was still thinking I had to know it all. That was a huge, mm-hmm, huge thing to learn, you know, that you had to know what resources were, but you didn't necessarily have to be the storehouse of knowledge of everything. That was a big lesson. Anyway, so the staff at the time was Ed Weidenfeller, who was the director and advisor full-time, Fran Sundin, who was the office manager,
mm-hmm, Chief Secretary. Civil servant.
Yeah. One student in the front office who sort of did the more receptionist kinds, mm-hmm, of, I mean reception in the sense of the initial person that people came in and met.
How many hours a week about with that student or students? Was it more than one?
Probably 20, 30. It was usually one at a time. Actually, you know, sometimes it was a student worker, but sometimes it was actually a classified staff person.
Part-time.
Uh-huh. And I was part-time. I was half-time. When I was hired, I was a half. So there was an advisor and a half.
Mm.
For the entire College of Letters and Science, Family Resources, and in addition to this, Fran Sundin coordinated the on-campus recruiting, which meant, because we were not centralized, that the Ag office, which was headed by Scott Johnson, the engineering office, I can't remember the name of the director.
Jim Marks,
and then Karen Stoffaker, most, mm-hmm, of my time. Bob Heideman, and then Tom Kelly,
yeah,
in education.
Oh, yeah.
And Sandy Arndt in engineering. Oh, but Jim Marks actually was engineering, and then Sandy Arndt.
Mm-hmm.
When people wanted to come.
Karen Stauffacher would be business.
Business,
later. Yes,
right. Yeah, and I can't remember the name of the business. Ed somebody?
I
don't remember.
Yeah, oh boy.
I can't remember. It wasn't very long, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, my peers really were Scott Johnson, Sandy Arndt, Tom Kelly, and Karen Stauffacher.
Okay. So you're saying that the call that a particular company was coming would come to Fran Sundin, and then
it would get coordinated.
Mm-hmm. Would the
pre-computers? There were no computers.
Right. Okay.
It was all done.
And was the telephone were the individuals paper. Saying that they'd like to see six engineers and 10 Aggies or something like that?
And then Fran would, and then of course some liberal arts students. So. Mm. Fran would call the other offices, and they would all she would coordinate these visits. It's really astounding to me now when I think of, by the time I had retired, the way that this was done. And as you, I believe, remember, when we were in the basement of Science Hall, which is where we originally were, students would line up. They'd sign up and line up a little bit later, but to interview, they didn't even know if they were going to be able to interview. You know, they would just, it was like getting tickets for a concert or something.
Right.
Which is completely different from how, we can talk about how it changed. But so anyway, Ed Weidenfeller, that summer of 77, suddenly died of a heart ailment. He had been traveling with his son, I think, in the Drum and Bugle Corps, and he died. He was a man who was probably 36, 37, I don't know, 40 maybe?
I think
maybe
about 40. Yeah.
40.
Mm-hmm.
And so aside from that being a personal blow, because he was a very kind person in my life, he'd given me a chance that changed my life,
mm-hmm,
really. my career, because of him, I had a really happy, fulfilling, successful career because he let me in that door, saw something in me. So I was very grateful, but also he was just a really nice guy, and anyway, he died, and so then, there I was. I became full-time advisor, because now, I mean, they couldn't survive the office with a half-time, brand new. I mean, I had just February is when I think I was hired, of 77. This was in the summer, that following summer.
Right.
So I became full-time, and then a new director was hired perhaps that fall, Tom Johnson. He had been, I believe, at Indiana University, and he became the director. So Tom and Fran and I and that front office person continued in the basement of Science Hall. One of the interesting things that happened was during an on-campus visit.
Was this prior to Tom's coming on board? Or
no, Tom was on board.
But not in the office?
But Tom was not in the office. Thank you. Tom was not in the office that day. And the location, well, and McDonnell Douglas was one of the firms that was interviewing liberal arts students that day in Science Hall. There were rooms for interviewing. And my office happened to be on the corner of Park and the Hill, Observatory Drive, and I, from my vantage point, could see the library mall and the fountain. It was a fantastic office. I was very lucky. Big, huge windows. Anyway, I noticed that students were gathering into a, as it turned out, protest. Now, how I knew that it was a protest against McDonnell Douglas, I'm not sure. There must have been rumors to that effect or something.
Well, there probably were. Plus, there was a certain style of getting the protest group together.
Yes.
Carrying signs.
Yes,
often,
yes.
Right?
Kind of a clue there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the group started to advance on Science Hall, and I realized that the front office person and I, we were the only staff people there. Tom, whether he was at a conference or I don't know, he was not there. So I got on the phone and called campus security, told the person who answered the phone that there were students advancing, that there was an interview, blah, 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 blah. And she said, no, our information is that nothing is going on. I said, I can see them right as we speak. They're coming in the back door of the building. So by the time the university police arrived, the students had, I wouldn't say grabbed the recruiter from McDonnell Douglas, but they had somehow gotten her to be in the main room, and they were surrounding her, and they had her on mock trial. And she was a young woman. It was her first recruiting trip. No one had warned her about Wisconsin, you know. And they were saying things like, you know, how can you live with yourself and sleep at night knowing that you're not only working for, but recruiting people to work for a company that builds machines of death, war machines. And she was crying, and she said, well, you know, we make cosmetics, too. Anyway, the police arrived, this tall police officer, Phil Dixon. I'll never forget him. Lieutenant Dixon came in. He's a tall guy, and he stood next to me. I'm a short person with his arms crossed, and he looked down at me in the front office, and he said, who's in charge here? And I looked around, and I said, I guess I am. And he said, well, what do you want us to do? So this is when I felt conflict, because there was a part of me that thought students did have the right to protest the presence of McDonnell Douglas, but I also thought McDonnell Douglas had the right to be there and other students had the right to interview with them, and I certainly felt that the person who was representing McDonnell Douglas had the right to not be frightened and intimidated. So I felt a lot of different feelings. Because I wasn't so crazy about the fact that they were there either, but I didn't think that was my...
That's a very significant point, I think, to make for anybody thinking about many of the university employees in this time period. They had several different feelings about each incident.
Yeah.
Often sympathetic to what the student's overall goal was, and yet conflicted in terms of keeping the university open, and you know, it was a tough time to deal with
that. It was a tough time.
And many people lived with it for many years after that. And uncomfortably.
And I think that it's also partly about the University of Wisconsin that these issues even were so alive to staff and students, you know? I mean, I think some universities probably were not even dealing with some of it. I don't know. So anyway, they did allow the police did allow the students to protest, but they also, you know, made sure that order was restored. And I think that was the best possible, you know, outcome, but it was an interesting moment. We then left Science Hall. The Institute of Environmental Studies and Art, whose name I'm blanking on, somehow inherited the space we were in.
Well, he was the director at the time.
Yes. Yeah. I can't think of his last name. But we got moved to 905 University Avenue, which was what we called the old bank building on the corner of Park and University with a Bucky Badger clock.
What year was this?
I don't know.
Because I was thinking the symbolism. I don't remember that being a problem in symbolism, but it could have been if it had been the late 60s, certainly.
Yeah, well, this would be
we're
the
talking
early
late 70s. Yeah.
I think I actually think it might even have been the 80s.
I think so, too.
By
then. Okay.
And I do remember, I had a lot of plants in my office, and I borrowed a dolly, and I put a lot of plants on there to walk down the street with my plants. And Nancy Abraham, who was at the time working probably in the Peterson building.
No, 80, she'd have been in the little house on...
Yes. Where the
summer program, sessions
summer
and special
sessions
students,
on.
Yeah.
Anyway, she saw me, and she later said to me, "I had so much respect for you that you moved your own plants. You didn't call someone to move your plants for you." You know, everything in those days was significant. Mm. You know, everything that everyone did somehow had more meaning than simply...
Well, sure, because it's, know, in that case, it's also
meaning.
The early feminist questions
on
the table as well.
And also, I also think that there was... I think that Nancy Abraham is one of these self-made women in the sense that she had started, I believe, as a classified person,
gone
to school as an adult, and then become academic staff or whatever she was. And I think that I often thought that there was tension between classified and academic staff. The rules were really different even though often you worked next to each other. You know, the faculty in a way were somehow physically and in terms of job responsibilities a little removed from that level. But academic staff and classified staff often worked side by side, both physically and even in terms of what they were doing. And yet, classified staff had, you know, a prescribed lunch hour. Hours, you had to be from 7:45 to 4:30. I remember Fran Sundin saying to me, because I used to come to work at 7:45 and stay till 4:30, you know, you don't have to do this. You're academic staff. And that was like thunder, because she was my only model. Because when Ed had died and before we got a new director, I just kind of, you know, imprinted on her.
Sure.
She took me under her wing. So anyway, this whole, I think that was another part of Nancy's comment. It was sort of this notion that academic staff were privileged in some ways. We were sort of mid, you know, the middle. We were not, didn't have all the privileges of faculty, but we definitely had privileges that classified staff, and there were some tensions, I think, around that issue.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I think that was also what she was saying. A little bit, but you did that yourself. Anyway, so we moved to the bank building, the old bank building that housed Student Counseling Center. Summer Sessions moved there. I'm trying to remember. There were certain private offices there. The Peg Geisler
Continuing Ed
Services moved to the second floor, which was turned out that was one of the offices that we interfaced with a lot, because initially we had a mission that did not limit whom we could serve. So we would see people from the community sometimes. We would see people who were not necessarily in letters and science. Okay. So anyway, we moved there. The staff grew a bit. And the mission of the office changed somewhat. So the notion of placement, the term placement that most of the career advisors, advising office, career advising and placement, really became less and it became more of a misnomer. Because if you were talking about students in liberal arts and social sciences, there was not always a clear job that you could associate with, what you know, with an English major, a sociology major, a Spanish major. So a big part of my job as a career advisor was in exploring with a student not just what their degree was in, not just how to write a resume, not just how to interview, although we did that, but who were they?
Mm.
What were their values? What were their goals? What did they want from work? Why did they major in what they majored in? What were some of their skills, interests, goals, the whole person, you know? And so there was that, and then there was the notion that we were, in many ways, the place that interfaced between the university and the outside world, and there was this moment where students who had really been students since they had been 5 years old, for the first time, couldn't rely on that anymore in terms of where to show up in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
Or who they were in the world. It was really a scary time. And so it was really important, I think, to be sensitive to that and to not just do the mechanical stuff and to not assume that people could be placed, which is so passive and so literal, but rather that you had to plan with them a process.
So they'd be at least leaving the university with skills, even if they had not at that point skills in looking for jobs or whatever, and thinking about different places, even if they had not placed themselves in a job by the time they...
Mm-hmm.
This might be a good place to take a little break.
Okay.
So let's do that and we'll come back to... All right, we're back after a brief pause, and we want to pick up the new role of the office in terms of how it's helping students. So,
I think for offices like engineering and business to some extent, there was the measure of success was often how many people came to, how many employers came to campus, and how many students landed jobs.
Mm-hmm.
For liberal arts students, that was not a useful measure. And a lot of our time was spent re-educating, frankly, students and, in fact, other staff, I would say, and parents occasionally at the SOAR program, to how this was different for a liberal arts student. For example, the typical liberal arts student didn't even land their first professional job until 6 months to a year after graduation.
Mm.
On-campus recruiting was not the measure for those students that it was for people in more technical fields. And so I think that we were constantly kind of having to reframe what it was that the students in the liberal arts and social sciences, what a successful trajectory looked like for them. And so we did do, as I said, you know, a lot of kind of exploring the person's values, experiences, skills. One of the problems was that a liberal arts, unlike the 60s, where a liberal arts degree was nothing to be ashamed of,
yeah,
and did in fact open a lot of doors, pardon me, now it was a challenge for students to celebrate why they had majored in the liberal arts and what they had learned, what they knew how to do that was transferable to the job market. And that was a big part of what we did, you know, and I think that that was a big part of how we helped was to have people think differently about what they had done. And for example, we could justify, you know, it turned out that, you know, statistically you can prove anything, but the overwhelming majority of CEOs in the 70s and 80s and 90s had been liberal arts majors. They were not MBAs.
Mm.
Now, I think this has changed, perhaps, but you could, you know, you could just say, I mean, that it was true. And I also think the notion that, you know, you get your, that the model that you a person completes a certain level of education, is employed in whatever field that prepared them for, will work there for 40 or 50 years, retire, get the gold watch, and then drop dead. That whole kind of, that's what a lot of parents, by the way, the world of work for the parents of these students was like that. It wasn't true anymore. People were changing jobs. New fields were opening up. People themselves no longer were satisfied. It wasn't just about earning money. It was about wanting to change and develop a new way. So it was a much more mobile, dynamic kind of world of work. So that was really exciting, you know, to be able to kind of bring some. I can remember speaking at the SOAR program when Pat Watkins was running the SOAR program.
Explain what SOAR is, though.
The Summer Orientation and Registration. It's the program that brought parents and freshmen to the campus before they would actually begin their freshman year to kind of orient them to the resources. And there were various speakers.
And you were.
In fact, you may be amused, I hope. I used to follow Paul Ginsberg, who was the Dean of Students, would talk about all the dire psychological things that would happen to their sons and parents would be sitting here listening to this, sons and daughters. This is the parents program. And then Karen Davenport?
Yes, she was Karen.
Who was the university police spokesperson.
Karen Donahue, maybe? Anyway,
yes.
It's an Irish name, later Karen Hansen.
Yeah, Hansen, Karen Hansen.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk about all the crime, you know, the thefts and the date rape and the, and then I would come on and I would say, in the event that your students actually survive to senior year, then they'll come see us and we can talk to them about how to find jobs. But anyway, parents were a tough audience, by the way. They were a very tough audience, partly because it was their kids,
mm-hmm.
and partly because if they had college degrees, they assumed that it would be easy to find a job because it had been for that generation. And if they didn't have a college degree, they thought that a college degree was a passport. That was a tough but challenging and interesting group because students really needed their parents' support emotionally and psychologically for this transition out, you know, after they graduated.
Mm-hmm.
It was a really tough time. Okay. So the office grew in staff. We hired, a part-time intern who became a part-time advisor. Tom had an associate director who did some administrative stuff. We hired a full-time on-campus recruiting coordinator, Solomon Woldesmiat. Tim Putzier assisted Tom in many ways. And I was sort of the head of the advising part, if you will. So that meant coordinating workshops on interviewing and resume writing. It meant planning larger programs such as careers in the public sector, where we would bring the state and federal employees to the Great Hall, maybe 20, 30, 40 of them, and have students who didn't want to go into traditional business kinds of play, but wanted maybe alternative careers or social service careers, could meet with employers. This was an interesting group. There were graduate students who thought they had wanted to pursue academic programs, PhDs, ABDs, master's programs, who weren't finding jobs in academia, who were really disenchanted. And so we did alternative careers for graduate students.
Mm.
One day a year on a Saturday. And what was so we would talk about how to translate or change a CV into a resume, or the kind of language, you know, that you would need to make that a document that people in non-academic worlds could understand, and to not rely passively on academic symbols for achievement and success and skills. And we dealt with a lot of anger, a lot of fear. I mean, students, I think, sometimes felt, graduate students, that they had to put on a brown paper bag because it was so taboo. They were even daring to look at non-academic jobs because academia, of course, was the ideal. It was very interesting. It was an interesting group. A lot of women in science. Yes.
I just want to ask one. You used the word coordination, and I wondered, are we still talking about coordinating for business and engineering and so on, or
no.
Has that gone by the boards? So when you're talking about coordinating, you're referring to just coordinating within LNS kinds of activity.
That's a really good point. What began happening is that there was so much on-campus recruiting at certain times, it was not realistic anymore for one office to be coordinating it. Each office, we decentralized. I don't know that we were ever centralized officially, but we were really decentralized now, officially.
Mm-hmm.
So each career advising office, engineering, business education, ag, and letters and science, coordinated its own on-campus recruiting activities, which is why, for example, we hired a person to do just that. And, of course, the advent of the computer was revolutionary, because a lot of that stuff now could be done that way, and that was a completely different kind of job, and it required different kinds of skills to coordinate that.
Now, just one other question on that is, are the corporations to some extent determining that they would like to see so many LNS, in, you know, even though they might be here primarily for business majors, mm-hmm. are they saying they might want to see LNS majors? Mm-hmm. And if so, how does the LNS student get that information? Because it, you're being told that that's the case, or the student has to be smart enough to also enroll in business or get online, as it were, with business.
Well, if I can back up a tiny
please.
Bit, we used to do what we call major meetings in the fall, which was coordinated with the undergrad advisors, you know, the journalism, Linda Loofborough, Ellen Jacobson in Comm Arts, Joe Elder in sociology, Arlene Davenport in psychology, Carol Tarr in English, in my generation, Ernie Vanderlyn in political science, Amy Lane Davis, Nancy Sugden in econ, and Mike Boychuk in math. Those, we used to meet with the undergrad advisors would coordinate a meeting with their upcoming seniors. This is in September, and a faculty member who would come. And what I would talk about was how to use the career advising, not just mostly me, but turned out to be other people when we had more people, how to use the career advising office. And the professor would talk about how to pursue graduate school, how to apply and all that. We would hand out to upcoming seniors a schedule of upcoming, among other things, not only events and workshops, but recruiters' schedules.
Mm-hmm.
So the person coordinating this would know way ahead of time who was supposed to be coming in the fall, and then who was supposed to be coming in the spring semester to do on-campus recruiting. Some companies would come twice. And there were many employers who wanted, when they came here, to make the most efficient use of their time and would have a couple of interviewers in engineering, in business, and in, say, letters and science.
So they'd have multiple staff themselves on campus. Right?
Procter & Gamble was an example. It was always so much fun when they came, because they were tremendously generous. They would always take everyone out to dinner. They were very friendly. And they would come to us for people they wanted to train to do sales. But at the same time, they might also need some technical people or some. So that was an example. Merck Sharp and Dohme, what used to be Merck Sharp and Dohme Pharmaceutical, now I believe it's just Merck, I'm not sure. You know, they would also come for liberal arts majors for the sales, maybe go to ag for the pharmaceutical, for the technically the scientists, you know, or to. So many of these larger companies would simultaneously interview in various offices at the same time. Others wanted to come only for a particular kind of major. And of course, for the liberal arts majors, a lot of the not-for-profit sector would only come to us. So the answer is both. There were some employers who wanted to, while they were here, go to several offices. There were some who wanted to come only to liberal arts or letters and science. And all of that was going on. And students would know about that. Now, I imagine they know about it online.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, we would have a written schedule, and they would have to register with the office, and then schedules would be devised through certain kind of, you know, mechanical procedures so that they would do on-campus interviewing. Typically, an employer would see maybe 12 students a day.
Mm.
Yeah, for half-hour interviews. And but once again, you know, that was sort of visible, and that was sort of what a lot of students thought they should be doing, without having done what I think the preparatory work, which was essential, which was not just how to interview, although that too, and resume. Well, the truth of the matter is that the mechanical things of doing a resume and interviewing effectively are dependent on knowing who you are and knowing how to talk about who you are in those forms. So individual appointments were as important as, say, workshops on how to workshops,
mm-hmm.
you know. So It was really amazingly wonderful work. And I think that it continues. And the other thing that was really meaningful about working in career advising is that there was all the staff. There were all the dean of students staff. I don't mean dean of students staff. I'm sorry. I mean the South Hall staff.
Or LNS student affairs.
LNS student affairs staff. And then there were the undergraduate academic advisors who mm-hmm. I just named. And then there were people who ran like the Multicultural Student Center, like Candace McDowell, or what we all had in common is we knew individual students, and we dealt with different parts of their needs, but we would often refer students back and forth for other aspects of what they needed, and the student benefited by having a more complete kind of process and help. Because it wasn't just the grades or just how to interview, or it was just a real staff partnership.
Was there any formal organization of staff accomplishing that, or is it largely informal?
Both. There was certainly a placement career advising organization we would meet periodically. Academic advisors who did periodically meet would usually invite me or whoever to attend those meetings.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we didn't necessarily stay for all of it.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it was too intense, but there was that. I think that a lot of it was informal, when I think about it, but occasionally we would be invited to speak at a meeting or to just be there when things were going on.
The campus through these years always was gearing up one program after another to try and do a better job reaching minority students. Can you talk a little bit about that and the interaction with the various minority offices?
Yeah. What used to be called one of the programs on campus, which was originally called the five-year program when Jim Doyle's mother, Ruth Doyle, I believe, was the originator of that program for somehow. The five-year program, which became the academic advancement program, which was geared toward identifying students of color in various cities who might not ordinarily be thought of as college students, but who showed some potential and with a little bit of perhaps extra tutoring or attention might succeed here, many of the minority students who were here on the undergraduate level came here through that program.
Okay.
And so that staff, Yvonne Bowen, Kay Simmons, Ben Rodriguez, Linda McCarroll, were absolutely colleagues the way undergrad. We would refer people back and forth. I was often invited to come and do a presentation. Orientation in the fall for minority students came to that, as well as for, by the way, the Office of International Students and faculty. And there was a lot of cross pollination. I don't know what to call it. The program, and I'm blanking on the cross college advising service.
Oh yes.
Was doing with freshmen and sophomores what we frequently were doing with juniors, seniors, and grad students. There were many times when we would either refer students or come and make presentations. But in my case personally, because minority, making sure that we had a fair, diverse cultural and racial environment was one that was particularly meaningful to me. I was often the person who once a week we would do advising at the Multicultural Center in the Red Gym, just with minority students, for example, or with student organizations. And I wanted to just share, if I could, an anecdote that for me as a person and as a professional really reorganized the molecules of how I thought about a lot of this stuff. I had an appointment with a young woman to come to have her resume looked at. She was African American. And she lived in one of the dorms just across the street. And she was quite late for her appointment. And when she came, she apologized. She said, I'm sorry that I'm late, but I just had this horrible racist incident happen in the dorm, and it upset me and it delayed me. And I said, what happened? And she said, well, I had been given an assignment for class to watch a particular program on TV. The TV's in the lounge. I had gone down, and there were two white girls watching something, and I said, I need to watch this program. And they were really annoyed with me, and they were really rude, and they left, and they just were horrible to me. And inside my head, I was thinking, I'm not sure that was a racist incident. They might have just been annoyed by anyone who would come in and tell them.
Interrupted their favorite program. Huh?
But I fortunately didn't say anything. I just listened to her. And the first thing I felt was, she's trusting me, who is white, with this information. I'm not interested in insulting her by revising her sense of what happened to her. That's not helpful, and it's not accurate. I don't know, there is no absolute way to measure what happened there. The second thing I thought was that old expression, when you're black, everything is about race, and when you're white, nothing is about race. And that there's a lot of truth to that. And thirdly, I thought, I don't want to insult her. She's already feeling insulted. It felt racial to her.
Mm-hmm.
By telling her what her reality is. It's not my business. So I think that one of the things that I really learned was that often white staff at the university, I think, well-intentioned, try to deflect what students of color would call racist. Oh, they were just kidding. Oh, there's another way of looking at that. Oh, that's not what they meant. That was the double insult.
Mm.
Not only did something racist happen for that person who felt it that way, but then you were trying to talk them out of their perception of what had just happened to them. And I really never, I committed myself to never, ever, ever doing that. I just wanted to never be someone who did that. It was very, very important. And I think that if I were training people in interracial stuff, that would probably be one of the most principal things that I would want to have addressed and looked at and explored. Because I think there is a gut level tendency for white people, when they hear of something racist, to, out of good intention sometimes,
mm-hmm.
to say, oh no, that's not what happened.
Right. Defend the brethren.
Defend, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, anyway, so that's just a story. I always thought that was an important moment, an aha moment for me.
Definitely. Oh, can you talk a little bit more about the interactions? We talked earlier about the corporations coming, but when they were here, the businesses or state agencies may have come, were you able to have discussions that went just beyond, we're going to get six students for you and this kind of thing that you feel might have helped both parties get a handle on things?
I mean, it was sort of informal, but I always made sure that we chatted with in my office. And Tom, the director, did a lot of this as well. We chatted personally, face-to-face, with people who were coming, partly as a courtesy, but partly to exchange, to learn from them what they were looking for, to talk, to find out what their reactions were to particular students, perhaps, although usually it was more general,
mm-hmm.
And to find out what the trends were, what kinds of jobs. So I think there was a lot. That was another thing that I think was very valuable and unique to this office, was that opportunity to sit down face-to-face and have a substantial exchange about what qualities they were seeking, what were some of the successes of our students, what were some of the challenges that we might be doing a better job with. And also, there was a tremendous interest in identifying minority students
mm-hmm.
in the 80s and 90s. I retired in 2000, so, you know, it's between 1980 and 2000, most of my comments are about that 20-year
period, yeah.
Which I think did change. I mean, I do think we saw more diversity and We definitely, we knew people. We would pick up, you know, they would pick up the phone. We would pick up the phone.
What about with the Chancellor Scholars Program? Any contact there?
I was in the Chancellor Scholar. I mean, I had.
Yes.
But I would not say that the office particularly officially did. Mm. Yeah. Pardon me.
Do you think we've covered the aspects of the office sufficiently now, or at this point? Because the next question I would ask you, if we have, would be what other parts of your career at UW were just enjoyable or, conversely, by the way the organization ran and that sort of thing.
Something that I did find difficult, and something that I've is this chain of command. I'm using that expression. I do feel that the university's the structure professionally is a little was a, from my point of view a little bit. I don't know what word to use, but that if you were academic staff, 99% of the time academic staff is who your colleagues were. I mean, some of this is logical, obviously. Faculty, you know, or administrators, managers, directors, that there was a real, that there were, I think, sometimes some artificial separation that would have been healthier if people could have just talked to each other a little bit more. I realize it's not efficient sometimes. You can't talk to everybody all of the time. No one would ever get their job done, neither in the administrative nor in the day-to-day student services. But it did feel like it would be that sometimes decisions were being made, policy decisions, in isolation from someone really being on the front. They were not the people who were on the front lines. Mm-hmm. And that there was not much opportunity. There was a lot of in-between. There were a lot of in-between people who would not either encourage or who might even actually feel threatened by some more direct kinds of communication. I don't know if I'm articulating this clearly, but I think if there were one thing I would change about what it was like to work at the university, it would be that I thought there should have been more integrated kinds of exchanges of information.
Okay.
But having said that, that's about my only complaint, and not a very big one. There are amazing people who work here, amazingly dedicated to students, and that it was always stimulating, you know, every day, really, you know, well, you know, working at the university, every day you met interesting people, whether they were students or staff or people who were visiting the university or employers. I mean, that. There was one of my biggest fears when I retired was that I wouldn't have, you know, you didn't have to do anything but show up and there would be interesting people in your office. You know
That's
what
true,
I mean?
Sure.
And issues. So how many work environments, you know, are that way? I don't think very many. And I was worried that when I retired, I would, you know, never meet anybody interesting, which is not true because there are interesting people everywhere in the world, really. There are. But there is something about the university that brings together a lot of really terrific people who are interested in things and dedicated to things and have passion. And so I'm not sure that that's what you're driving at, but.
I did feel
in my own office tremendous freedom to be who I was and to say what I thought. I mean, amazing. I have to sing Tom Johnson's praises. He may not always have agreed with me, but I always felt listened to, and I really did feel respected and like my ideas mattered. You know, I ran a little control group. We were looking at racism and sexism in academic staff, what people on the staff were feeling about these things in the institution.
Mm-hmm.
We had these little, not control groups, what are little...
quality circles or something?
Well, one of those, yeah, you know. Just information gathering. And I remember, you know, Actually, first of all, one of the things that was interesting is that women as a group had some of the same gripes as people of color, you know, had. Mm-hmm. But and I suppose that's not that surprising. But I always felt when I left these how lucky I was, because I never experienced any of these things in my own office, you know. I always felt like everyone really got to say what they thought and be who they were. And that was one of Tom Johnson's, I think, greatest strengths as a director, was that he was very open to and tolerant of people just being who they were in an authentic way, which a lot of people can't say about
That's a nice comment.
The people for whom they work, you know. And I miss him, you know, personally, too, because mm-hmm. he was a good friend. So, but I did feel like very, very much kept away from, I mean, not personally, but felt that it was hard to reach, really reach face to face, really just talk, schmooze with people who are not on your level sometimes in terms of the job title or the, you know?
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, the terrace was great. Nothing like the terrace. The students were, you know, fantastic. The range, the fullness of the experience of working at the university I feel so lucky. I'm glad I'm not working anymore. I don't want to work anymore. But I do not regret a day of
That's a good feeling, isn't
working
it?
Working here, yeah. Yeah.
I think we should pause here a minute.
Oh, yeah.
This concludes the interview with May Freitas on June 17th, 2010.